I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Girl, and today I'm joined by the legendary chef Mark Hicks. Mark's original take on British food has seen him rise to fame, initially as chef director at Caprice Holdings for nearly two decades before opening his first of many restaurants, Hicks Oyster and Chop House in London in 2008. As well as having two winning dishes on the Great British Menu, Mark was awarded an MBE for his services in hospitality. 2020 saw Mark embark on a reinvention of himself with the Hicks Oyster and Fish Truck in his native town. We're incredibly lucky to have Mark chatting with us today. Mark, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Yeah, I've been making the most of it, you know, working, selling a bit of fish from the local fishermen.
Yeah.
So that's kind of kept me fairly busy. You know, I'm doing that sort of 4 days a week. So the local community love that. And, you know, the fishermen, when they can get out, you know, it's, I'm looking at the sea at the moment and, yeah, the weather hasn't been great, but also the problem is the fish prices are not very good. So it's not really worth, some of them are actually even, you know, putting fuel in the boat and going out. But I did get a lovely delivery of live Lion Bay prawns last night, which I've just cooked.
Oh, lovely.
So they'll be on sale on the truck. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds amazing. And you just had a little one around the start of lockdown. That must be lovely, having a baby in the house.
Yeah, we don't live together.
Okay.
So it was the year. So just over a year ago. But my little daughter, Isla, is coming down. They're on the way down from London just for a couple of days.
Lovely.
So I'm not going to London that much. I'm going to London this week just for an operation, a hernia operation.
Oh my gosh, sorry to hear that. Yeah, it sounds painful.
I've had one before, so it's the second one now.
Oh, blimey.
it's lifting those boxes of fish around.
Oh, I bet. Oh, that's awful. I'm so sorry to hear that. So you mentioned Isla. You guys love to go fishing together, is that right? Is that what you're going to do together?
Yeah, we didn't really make it out much this year, but the previous year we did a bit of fishing. I sort of lose track of the years now. Last year was pretty much lockdown, so she likes to come out of the boat and catch a bit of mackerel. She gets a bit bored on the riverbank.
Okay.
But yeah.
It's a lovely
my,
thing.
My older daughters, My older daughters aren't really into fishing, but Lydia draws very good fishy illustrations, which I'll show you.
Okay.
So she's been doing, I'm doing a range of smoking.
Amazing.
So she's been making some nice illustrations.
Wow.
For the packaging here. Yeah.
Oh, very, very talented. And I mean, do your older daughters cook? Are they interested in the hospitality?
Yeah, they both love food. Isla loves food, and I'm sure Sunny, the new one, will love his food. So the whole family are pretty much into the food. Lydia draws, you know, all sorts of different illustrations. Ellie cooks, and Isla, I don't know what she's going to do.
Brilliant. So you were actually born in West Bay yourself and raised by your grandparents. Describe to us a young Mark Hicks, and what was life like for you back then?
Well, my parents split up when I was six and my brother was four, and then we were separated. So I spent a lot of time living sort of, you know, with my dad and my grandparents. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of interesting because my granddad was a bit of a multitasker. You know, he was the mayor of the town, he ran a local pub, he had a painting and decorating business, he was the chairman of the football club, he was a prize chrysanthemum grower. So
wow.
I gained a little bit of interest from his gardening. I'm not that good at it, but I do love doing it. So I can, you know, this time of year I can survive, you know, on vegetables from my garden, apart from apart from carrots and potatoes and onions, which I don't bother growing.
So it sounds like your granddad, he was sort of a big influence in your life.
Yeah, so he was interesting. So we used to sit at night watching things like 40 Towers and the Two Ronnies, mm-hmm. whilst he was on his chair sort of doing invoices for his painting and decorating business. Okay. And so I would say, you know, much later in life, I realised that he was quite a big influence on, you know, me making myself busy, I suppose.
And did you ever get the chance to see your brother regularly at that time?
We used to see each other occasionally at school and stuff, but we're back in touch now and we see each other quite often.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
He lives down here as well, yeah.
Okay, and did he also go into the hospitality industry?
No, he didn't. I was the only one. When I was sort of growing up, I played golf a lot. All my friends went off to become golf pros. I didn't know what I wanted to do, really, to be honest, when I was at school. So I ended up going to catering college after school. So I'd done domestic science in the fifth year, which was the first time boys had a choice of metalwork or domestic science. Uh-huh. So three of us thought it'd be a good idea to be in a classroom full of girls. And when we turned up on day one, all the girls decided to do metalwork. there was just three of us and the teacher.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame. But you stuck with it though, regardless.
Yeah, I stuck with it. Went to London and I loved it really. I didn't really come back to Dorset an awful lot in the beginning. And then sort of later in life, you learn to sort of appreciate, where you were grown up, overlooking the sea and stuff. So.
Right. So I guess, you know, with your culinary career, things really changed for you when you met Laurie Mills, is that right?
Yeah, so Laurie was my lecturer at college. And he was a big sort of influencer, if you like.
Yeah,
because he always talked about food and we used to hang out together. And yeah, looking back on it, you know, I think he was the one that really got me interested, because, you know, you can go through college life and whatever it is you decide to do and not particularly be that interested in the subject that you're studying. Whereas I sort of grasped it and then couldn't wait to move to London.
Yeah, I mean, your culinary career has been phenomenal. Just to name a few, in your early days, you were at Grosvenor House under Anton Edelman, and then you moved on to the Dorchester under Anton Mozyman. Then you worked your way up, became head chef at just 22. When you look back over that time, did you find it challenging and difficult, or did it come very, very naturally to you?
I suppose it was a little bit natural, you know. Obviously, at an early age, I wasn't as experienced in the management side, which I sort of, you know, quickly sort of grasped as you would do, really. I think if you're keen on food and you love cooking, then, you know, it's a natural thing to sort of progress on, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, you progressed so quickly. I mean, was it at 26 you became executive chef at Caprice Holdings?
Yeah, 26 or 27, I think, something like that, yeah.
pretty quick.
That was a big, you know, that was a big learning curve for me, working for Chris Corbin and Jeremy King, because they were, you know, fantastic restaurateurs, very focused on customer base. And I think that's where I sort of picked up an awful lot about, you know, the restaurant business, not just about the food necessarily, but about, you know, the whole element of it. You know, met some great people, you know, customers and that.
Right.
Who I still keep in touch with, you know, to this day. So.
Fab. Great for cultivating relationships, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was lucky. I was sort of given a membership to the Groucho Club, and, you know, when I started there. And
right.
Of course, there you do meet some interesting, colourful characters, if you like.
And you being one of them.
Well, yeah.
Well, you were with Caprice Holdings for 18 years before you decided to branch out on your own. What was the catalyst in that decision?
I suppose after 18 years and there was three different ownerships, two after Chris and Jeremy, I just thought, yeah, maybe it's time I just did something on my, you know, on my own, really, which I did with my then business partner, Ratnesh, who also worked at Caprice Holdings. He was finance director. So, yeah, we sort of started, you know, smallish, but it, momentum saying, you know, soon came along, and not only we got the oyster and chop house, and then the fish house in Lyme Regis came up, which made sort of sense, you know, back close to home and a sort of lovely fish restaurant overlooking the sea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was an interesting sort of, you know, start up on my own, really.
Yeah, I mean, to say that you flourished would really be an understatement. I mean, within 5 years, you had built your own empire, starting with the Hicks Oyster and Chop House in Smithfield, then Hicks Oyster and Fish House in Lyme Regis, as you mentioned, then Hicks in Soho, then a restaurant champagne bar in Selfridges, Hicks in Browns, Hicks in Belgravia, Tram Shed in Hoxton, Hicks City, yeah. And then Hickster in Bankside. Have I missed anything out?
No, I think that's about it. yeah, I suppose I maybe expanded a bit too much, as a lot of people, you know, discover in my business. And, you know, then it became sort of quite tough business-wise. You know, we made a bit of money in the beginning, but, you know, expansion and having a few restaurants doesn't always make you an awful lot of money necessarily.
So, and when you say tough, do you mean in terms of management?
No, not really. It was, I suppose, London, you know, there was more and more restaurants opening in London.
Competition.
Lots of competition, yeah. Yeah, and I sort of stood my ground and, you know, we ended up closing Belgravia and, you know, the one in the city. And we sort of downsized a little bit, if you like. Mm-hmm. And then I got new investment with new business partner, which was fine for a couple of years. Then it didn't quite sort of work out as I'd planned. And I'd been sort of thinking that I should maybe go out on my own again. So that's what kind of happened by default, really, you know, when the first bit of the virus came along.
Sadly, we've seen the restaurants close at the start of the pandemic. We've heard that this was a board decision. It wasn't yours. Are you able to talk us through what happened from the beginning? You said it was turbulent relationship from the beginning. When did you start working with the group?
It would have been about five and a half years ago, maybe now. I don't know. I've lost track of the last year, where it's gone.
Me too.
It was all good intentions. And I think just in the end, you know, I really had my heart on doing my own thing. And I think, you know, the sort of decision to put the business into administration, you know, it was a tough one to swallow because, you know, I wasn't part and parcel of the big picture and the big conversation. And it was you know, my partner had, you know, a very, very big business. So we were sort of small fry, I suppose, compared to the rest of the sort of corporate entities that they had. But, you know, I sort of reflect back on it and thinking, you know, okay, well, maybe it was the right thing to happen, you know, for me personally, not necessarily for the restaurants, but, you know, London was becoming tougher and tougher. And I'm just glad that I never decided to buy back any of the London restaurants from the administrators, which I could have done easily. And then I'd have sort of just got back into the same old routine, really. And, you know, for a long time, I wanted to sort of, you know, move back down to the West Country and, you know, sort of redo the business down here, which, you know, I've sort of started doing in between, you know, various lockdown closures. So,
Looking back over what's happened, I mean, I understand you sold the shares to grow the business. Would you, in hindsight, would you say you would have done things very differently, as in maybe grown on a slower?
No, probably not. I mean, you know, I think at the end of the day, when you go into business with new partners, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, it's very easy afterwards to say, yes, I would have done it slightly differently. But here we are. today with no restaurants open in the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough for everyone, I think. You know, there's lots of businesses that may not get through the other end. You know, it's pretty touch and go now, being sort of, you know, closed down for the third time. You've now got to start planning for when we eventually reopen, whenever that will be. But I'm sure, you know, lots of people will be, you know, itching to get back into restaurants and have, you know, have a good time and spend some money. So I'm sort of looking forward to the day that we can, you know, reopen and just get back to sort of normality, really.
Yeah, of course. We're all looking forward to exactly the same thing. But so for someone that puts their name at the center of their own brand, it was surprising actually to learn that you also gave away the rights to use your name.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the deal when I, you know, when we merged together with my new partners. And at the time, you don't think about it, you know, you think, okay, well, it'll put a bit of money in the bank for myself. And then as things progress, you know, and it sort of all went wrong, if you like, I then had to sort of buy back my IP rights and my name, which, again, I've experienced that with a lot of my friends. The same thing has happened, you know, where they've lost the rights to use their own name. So, and you learn, you know, you learn by these things, and, you know, you're able to advise people to, you know, hang on to it the best way you can. Which is, would be my advice to anyone, really. You know, don't lose your own name. Not completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess also don't lose so much control as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's very tricky. And the risk, you know, the restaurant business is a sort of fragile business. A lot of our problems in London were the greedy landlords who, you know, willy-nilly, without even a meeting or confrontation, would, you know, double the rent. So my restaurant in Soho, it was, you know, maybe breaking even, and then the landlord decides to, you know, double the rent to £500,000, which means that, you know, suddenly you're in the red. And the same happened, or was happening, as we closed in the restaurant in Bankside.
Right.
So yeah, it's quite hard to sort of survive when you haven't got a partnership with your landlord, I suppose.
Yeah.
Whereas down here in Dorset, you know, they're much more sort of personable, and, you know, you have relationships and partnerships with your landlords.
Yeah.
Whereas that tends not to really happen in London.
Right. And I think it's quite ironic, because now there's a lot of landlords struggling to actually
find empty shops.
Yeah, they're all completely empty now.
Yeah, which serves them right, really. I mean, you know, if you're going to force your tenants out by doubling the rent, you know, expect to have an empty premises with no rent coming in whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to change the industry moving forward. And I think that might be one of the aspects that does change. It might be the relationships between restaurateur and landlord to work better in terms of, you know, being able to sustain the working relationship and staying in the building.
Absolutely.
Other than a good relationship, how do you think that sort of relationship would work?
Well, I think, you know, things like turnover-based rent is very good. We did a similar thing in Selfridges. So, you know, when it's busy and the tenant's making money, the landlord is also making money. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, it's not so busy and not so good business, you know, it's in reverse. But I think, you know, if landlords are confident in the people that they take on as a tenant in a sort of partnership, then I think, you know, when it all goes back to normal, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that, you know, tenant landlord kind of, you know, sympathetic partnership, really.
Yeah, I think that's really important moving forward to kind of have a better understanding, and then everyone sort of does well out of it.
Yeah, exactly, because if you're making more profit, you don't mind sharing it with the person.
Yeah, and it's in everyone's interest to work together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What was the silver lining for you?
I've not found one yet.
You haven't found one yet.
I'm still looking for it. I suppose a lot of people in the restaurant business, unless it's a very different model, you know, if it's a high street chain, maybe, you know, pizzas and that sort of stuff, it's a little bit easier, you know, to make some money. But I think generally speaking, you know, restaurateurs, a lot of us do it because we love doing it and we enjoy it. And, you know, the financial gains aren't necessarily always that fruitful, really.
Yeah. And I mean, it's been a very difficult period for you. What do you do to keep, I guess, to keep calm and to keep a level head generally?
Drink good red wine. yeah, and just generally, you know, try and keep busy, whether it's a bit of writing, you know, selling fish. But, you know, hopefully not too long, I'll be back into the pub and I'll be able to start doing up the rooms. You know, I'm looking to get up to about 8 rooms eventually at the pub. Once we, you know, we start getting a bit of revenue in. So that's something, you know, to look forward to, you know, because I couldn't really afford to do the rooms when we closed because, you know, suddenly, you know, 2.5 good weeks, you know, everything stopped. And, you know, there wasn't enough money in the bank to even start investing in the rooms. So,
well, let's talk about your food truck for a second. So how did that idea come about? And, you know, so you're selling fish from your suppliers.
Direct from the fishermen. So basically I was sat in exactly the same position as I am now, overlooking the sea, as you can see.
Gorgeous. Beautiful.
And yeah, I had a sort of, you know, had a bottle of red wine in front of me thinking, right, okay, what am I going to do? I've got no restaurants. I haven't got a job. I've got no writing. I had a few books in the pipeline. So I thought, okay, maybe if I buy a food truck, I'm then able to operate and trade, you know, even when there's no restaurants open. So I went to my favorite online place, eBay, and this black converted Chevrolet ambulance popped up. And it was on for about 16,000. I put a silly little bid in for maybe half that price.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, it was accepted. So I went to London. It was all kitted out. But at that point, I didn't really know what I was going to do with it. I didn't know if I was going to do, you know, hot food only or what. And then I suddenly thought to myself, you know, when I was looking at the sea, I thought, you know, I've got great relationships with the local fishermen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to support them and, you know, supply, you know, good fish with the provenance to the locals, which I started doing. You know, it was tough in the beginning. The first week, me and Jezza, you know, walked home with 150 quid each.
Wow.
But it got better. You know, we got a good reputation and people knew that they could come and buy fish that was, you know, landed in line direct from the boats. And then I met someone who operates out of Plymouth. So when the boats can't go out of Lyme Regis, then I get fish up from his boats. So I've always got a decent supply of fish. In fact, this afternoon, I've got to go meet them halfway in Exeter to pick up my my catch for tomorrow.
Okay, lovely. And so is there any the cooking that goes on?
Yeah, so the cooking, there was no cooking to begin with. Then I suddenly thought, because we had cooking facilities on the truck, I suddenly thought, oh, maybe I should do a few fishy snacks, you know, and people would come along and buy oysters to eat at the truck. So I started doing oyster po' boys, you know, the little deep fried oysters in a bun with sort of chili mayonnaise.
Oh, yum.
And that way I was kind of turning over the fish as well.
Right.
And then we started doing crispy fish sliders. You know, I smoke my own salmon. So there's always smoked salmon for sale on there. So the menu kind of developed into sort of 3 or 4 things. Sometimes we do a smoked salmon slider. We do the oyster po' boys, crispy fish. Sometimes we do crab, spicy crab fries. So the menu is kind of a changing menu. At the moment, I'm doing fish soup. So I'm using all the bones and the heads from the fish and selling, you know, little pots of soup. You know, it's bloody freezing there last week.
Yeah.
And the hot fish soup was very welcome.
And you have is it 10 recipe books now? Do you sell any of those on the truck?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's not always the best place to sell them, but I sell a few a week, you know, people that are genuinely interested.
Yeah.
Or they want a recipe, you know, it's quite an easy
and sort is of sell. And is 10 the number?
No, I've done a few more, probably 13 or something.
And I heard you've done a vegan cookbook as well.
Well, I'm about halfway through it, which
you're
I'm trying
doing
to
it. Okay.
sell to publishers at the moment.
Oh,
and it's not, you know, me being a sort of fish meaty person. I've got quite a lot of friends that are vegan. And I started sort of experimenting with good, wholesome vegan recipes, not seeds and quinoa and that sort of stuff. And yeah, started doing some interesting, you know, simple that sort of fit into the kind of food that I do normally, you know, whether it be woodland mushrooms on toast or, you know, that sort of stuff. So yes, I'm sort of ploughing through that book and just waiting to get a bite from the publisher, really.
Yeah, amazing. Do you always work with the same publisher?
Yeah, I did for years, Quadril, and I did most of my books with them. And I did a couple of books with other publishers, but because I don't do TV, then my books don't really sort of fly off the shelves. So,
right.
But let's
see. Is
there
a reason that you don't do TV?
I've kind of always avoided it in the past.
Why is that?
Well, because I just felt that it's quite difficult running restaurants from a TV studio. I'd much rather focus on doing the restaurants, right, and doing some writing, you know.
Yeah.
But interestingly, just of late, I've had quite a few people approaching me about doing, you know, stories about, you know, what happened, you know, what's been happening, what am I doing next? So let's see what. You know.
You're very well known for simple seasonal cooking. I mean, after all these years, what is your food philosophy and how has it changed or evolved over the years?
It's been, I suppose, you know, my sort of go-to, you know, thing or quote is really not more than 3 ingredients on the plate. So, you know, I wouldn't do a dish with 10 different things on it. And it's always, you know, very seasonal, well sourced, which is always been a natural thing for me to do, you know, on the menu, shout about the producer or the, you know, the fisherman or whatever. So I've always had that sort of ethos, you know, when cooking and putting a menu together.
Yeah. And so what are your favourite 3 ingredients?
Oh, it depends what time of the year it is, really. You know, things that have a very short season, like the prawns that I cooked earlier, you know, they were jumping around on my kitchen worktop whilst I was trying to get them in the pot. You know, they're delicious. You know, when this English asparagus comes into season, you know, I think we need to be able to celebrate that.
Yeah.
All the various different mushrooms that come into season and the game birds, although we copped out a bit this year, having to sort of close in December.
Yeah.
But I've got a few game dishes for reopening up my sleeve. And the nice thing of having the Fox pub, you know, which is very meaty and gamey, you know, it's a complete contrast to the fish house, which is, 99% fish.
Mm. We're going to talk about those two in a little bit. In my intro, I had mentioned your MBE that you received in 2017 for your services in hospitality. That must have been a massive career highlight for you.
Yeah, I mean, you sometimes wonder why you get nominated to go and collect one of these things. I didn't actively, you know, sort of go out and chase anything whatsoever like that. But it's just a nice thing to have under
really
your belt.
Really amazing accolade, isn't
and
it?
And for the family. Because when you sort of work in the hospitality business, quite often you don't really think about, you know, what you're doing, the good you're doing or the bad, whatever the case may be. It was a nice little surprise, really.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things that must have contributed was the Hicks Academy, which you opened in 2014. Is that a business that you're still running?
No, I don't do that anymore. I did it for a few years, and it's quite hard going into education these days. It's very different than when I was at catering college, you know, a different kind of teaching criteria and stuff. And I think these days, a lot of people that want to go into, you know, the restaurant or hotel business, they tend to sort of leave school and go straight into it now instead of going to, you know, catering college. But I am sort of considering, you know, doing another academy, if you like, but doing it, you know, within the restaurants, so sort of getting training.
Training, so real sort of hands-on experience.
Yeah, which I think tends to work, you know, a lot better, because I did have one lad that was a student at the Hicks Academy who suddenly stopped turning up for college, and then I walked into the fish house one day and he decided that, you know, he wanted to just work in a restaurant as opposed to going to college and not learning all up. So,
yeah.
So I think, you know, you can't beat hands-on physical experience.
Yeah, I totally agree, especially in your industry. You're a massive lover of art, and you even set up the Hicks Award for Emerging Artists, and you're good friends with Damien Hirst. Did you guys collaborate for the Hicks Award together?
Well, Damien did the award itself, the Bronze Hicks Award. And, you know, living in the East End for a long time, I got to know a lot of the YBA artists. A lot of them became friends. And, yeah, we collaborated on quite a few things. You know, in the restaurants, there were always commissions by a lot of these young British artists. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and you know, I started sort of collecting. And, you know, as you can see, looking around, I've got all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, you've got amazing pieces of art. And even in the restaurants, I mean, were they personally yours?
Yeah. Some of them were loans, but the majority were owned by myself. Yeah.
And so, you managed to get them all back from...
Yeah. Things like that you have to protect.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I heard you won through a raffle, Paul McCartney's signed guitar with a drawing from Tracy Emin.
Yeah, there was a local, I used to do a food festival here, which will hopefully be back next year, called Food Rocks. And a friend of ours, Jeff Baker, he did a thing alongside it called Guitars on the Beach. So he wanted to create a British world record with, 2,000 odd guitarists on the beach, all playing along. And that particular year, it's Ian Gillan, who lives in Lyme Regis from Deep Purple. We did Smoke on the Water, and we had boats off the shore with smoke machines. And we got this guitar and through Jeff, sponsored by Fender. And he got Paul McCartney to sign it because he used to work for him, and he asked if Tracy would do an illustration. Yeah. But I thought it was going to be like an auction, an online auction. And so a bit near the time, I said, when does the auction go live? And he said, no, that's a raffle. So I bought £1,000 worth of tickets and ended up getting it.
Oh, I'm sure it was worth it. That is that's a pretty cool guitar to have.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so going back to what you're up to now, and I know you managed to get the fish house back in Lyme Regis. You mentioned that earlier on. Was that a planned thing? Was that something that you kind of immediately knew you wanted to get that back?
Yeah, out of all the restaurants, and, you know, with moving back to Dorset in my sights, it was the obvious thing to try to buy back. It was quite a struggle because someone had put a bigger offer in, which I couldn't afford. And I've known the landlord who lives next door to the restaurant since I was a kid. So he made it, you know, sort of fairly difficult with restrictions and rights of way and that sort of stuff. Mm. And the buyers ended up, you know, pulling out, and I, you know, got it off the administrators for not a lot of money. So
amazing. So
that
again,
was my first step back in. Yeah. And yeah, so that was my first step back into the business.
Yeah, and then, I mean, so the Fox Inn, was that came afterwards?
Yeah, the Fox Inn was recent. I opened that in December. Okay. And on December the 10th, I crazily opened it on my birthday. But
We have something to celebrate. That's great. You've got two restaurants.
Yeah. So it's yeah, so that was great. And we had a really good 2.5 weeks. And yeah, and then sadly we had to close it, you know, just before before Christmas. So, you know, it's now been sitting there. But I've been doing my kitchen garden. You know, we've built a kitchen garden out the back. Well, I'll be growing a lot of the salads and herbs and unusual vegetables. And yeah, the next thing will be just to crack on with a couple of the rooms, okay, bit by bit.
Okay. So the rooms are in.
Yeah, so there's a couple of annexes. There's one room above the pub. And then I want to create some shepherd's huts up in the woodland there. So end up with about 8 bedrooms, which is perfect for shooting parties or, you know, whatever.
Okay. So I'm guessing it's pretty obvious because it's in the name, I guess. So Fox Inn is more, I guess, the meat-based menu, and then your yeah. The fish house is fish.
Yeah, so it's sort of 90% meat and game. And then the fish house is obviously fish.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of staff, I mean, obviously you've lost amazing teams, but they're all London based. So in terms of staff, are you going to get people who are local to you, or are people from London going to travel up for you?
Yeah, I've got a sort of an almost husband and wife team that have come down. So Andina runs the Oyster and Fish House, and her fiancé Spiros runs the pub. So I managed to rescue them from London. Huh. And all the other staff are sort of locals, really. You know, at the fish house, I'd managed to get, you know, most of the staff back working for us. And the Fox, yeah, a pretty new team, really. But I've had a couple of chefs come down from London to help me out.
Okay.
So it's been great.
Yeah. And do you think that you'll come back into London at any point?
No.
You're just done with London, are you?
Yeah, I am a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I'll keep my houseboat up there. And my daughter, my little daughter, lives up there at the moment. But I think they're thinking of moving down this part of the world, which, you know, why wouldn't you, really? You know, I think I've done my time in London, and I think, you know, going back to your roots, it's a good story, and, you know, there are more sort of opportunities, and I think you can have a much more realistic sort of business venture on the go down here, you know, with realistic rents, sourcing, you know, directly from the fishermen and the local gamekeepers and shoots and estates. Mm. So it's kind of, you know, a much easier way to do business, I think.
Really. Yeah, and I guess more importantly, it makes you happier.
It does, exactly. Yeah, you know, it wasn't planned at all, but now I'm here, and, you know, I've got a little business going, then yeah, it all sort of makes sense, really.
It's been a really big year for you. I mean, you've lost all your London restaurants, but you've gained 2 restaurants. And do you have plans on opening more where you are?
No, nothing. No, nothing at the moment. You know, I don't want to make the same mistake of expanding too much. So I'm just going to, get the pub going, get them up to speed, and then just, you know, I'm getting older, so I don't want to get old too quickly.
And in terms of, I mean, with your previous restaurants, Hicks in the name has been such a big part of the branding. And you've, as I understand, you've got the name back. Are you going to put Hicks in the fish house and in the Fox Inn? Are you going to change those?
Well, the thing is, people kind of, you know, used to call Hicks Oyster and Fish House the Oyster and Fish House anyway, so everyone knows my association with it. So currently I don't need to use my name, you know, above the door in any of the restaurants, but there's lots of other opportunities, whether it's some branding or, you know, books, that sort of stuff. So
And
I'll use it to its best and see what happens.
And what's going to happen with the truck? Are you going to keep doing that?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's got its sort of status now, and people know where I am on a sort of, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So I think, you know, keeping that going and feeding the local community, supporting the fishermen, you know, it's a good thing. You know, it's a great thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they'll look after you when you reopen.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, Mark, tell me something about yourself I couldn't possibly know.
Something about me you couldn't possibly know. That's a tricky one.
I know there's a lot of information.
Everyone seems to know most things about me these days. It's all been very well documented. Yeah, I suppose, you know, childhood memories, some of them are slightly vague, but, you know, I did love sort of playing golf and, you know, fishing as a kid. I suppose, you know, moving to London was a big stepping stone for me. And you sort of, you know, you grow out of Dorset a little bit and you grow up quite quickly and, you know, meet people. And I suppose over the years, there's been lots of sort of scenarios that, you know, people may not know about, but I can't think of one at the moment.
Okay, no worries. Well, if you remember one, pick up the phone, let me know.
I will. Well, I'll publish it in my Telegraph column. If I suddenly remember it, yeah.
Are you still doing the column?
Yeah, it's a weekly magazine column now, yeah. So it started off, there was a big piece that William Sitwell wrote back in the summer. And now, yeah, I've now got a weekly magazine page. So
amazing.
Yeah.
I met William, well, we didn't meet actually. It was a call with William Sitwell and Ollie Daboo. They did kind of a Q&A thing. And yeah, it's a nice guy. William Sitwell.
Yeah, I've known him for many years. When he came and reviewed Hick Soho, we always have a bit of a laugh about it because I always used to serve the drinks in these lovely vintage glasses that I used to buy from junk shops. And me and William were sat in the bar, and William decided to fall off the bar and break probably 50 of my old vintage glasses.
Oh no!
But it's quite fun.
It sounds like he was having fun.
A very big bill, but yeah.
And that's what hospitality is all about, right? It's, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of people go into it and stay in it because it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you do have, you have a great time and meet some great people. So I think I've got no regrets, you know, ever stepping into the world of, you know, restaurants and hotels and hospitality. Because it's always something interesting on a day-to-day basis that's happening.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what I find quite interesting about you, your sense of humor is absolutely brilliant, because there was an interview which I heard, and you named one of your desserts Credit Crunch ice cream because you were going through the Credit Crunch at the time.
I opened the Oyster and Chop House during Credit Crunch, and everyone said you're mad, you know, opening a restaurant that's serving all the meat on the bone during Credit Crunch, you know, and post BSE.
Yeah.
And I turned this sort of artisan caramel chocolate bar that a friend of mine gave me into an ice cream.
Yeah.
And we called it Credit Crunch ice cream and charged £1 a scoop.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. It's quite interesting that, you know, the press that you got around your food truck was amazing. And that idea, actually, there was so much hype around you losing your restaurants, but there was that one positive thing that came out of it. You know, someone owning a restaurant empire to basically going into a food truck. And there was a lot of on that. I thought that was really brilliant. It was, I mean, even though it wasn't planned, but.
Yeah, no, exactly. It wasn't planned at all. And, you know, it was quite sort of fortuitous that, you know, the truck sort of got the press and
and you kept yourself really current. And I think that, you know, at a time where everyone is losing jobs and everyone is thinking, what on earth do we do now? You kind of, you know, you just sort of told everyone in that way that you can start anywhere you want to. You can start from the ground up again. You can start fresh. You can start, start absolutely new. I thought that was a really great message.
Yeah, I think so, you know, and it's not that hard, you know, and I think if you do something that's slightly unique, maybe, you know, turning yourself into a fishmonger in a car park, you know, and serving oysters in a car park on the A35, you know, it's quite an interesting and sort of naturally unique thing to do, I suppose, really.
Yeah, it just shows that, you know, you kind of get up and go just to, you know, nothing's going to get you down. You're just going to get up and start again, and you got fighting spirit. I think
last Thursday I had a really good sale on the truck. I've got this lovely old Mercedes Benz that I, you know, the sports car 420 SL, which I've had for 20 odd years. And I decided, a friend of mine, why don't you stick it in the car park next to the truck? And half an hour later, a friend of mine came along and bought it for his wife. So it's... that's my biggest sale of the year.
Oh, wow.
I'm downsizing at the moment, so I'm trying to sell pieces of art that aren't that important to me. Some sort of kitchenalia, vintage lights, all that sort of stuff. So downsizing is a good thing to do,
Yeah. And what would you say is the art piece that you would never, ever sell? So your favourite piece of art that you've got in your collection?
Yeah, my favourite piece is one of the early pieces, which is a black and white Bridget Wiley from the 60s. And I bought it off Bridget, because I've known her quite well for a long time. So that's probably my most prized piece of art.
And what have you done with the cow?
Oh, well, that belonged to Damien, and they took it apart, and it's probably down in Gloucestershire at the big house.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's been really fun chatting with you, Mark. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for joining me. And I wish you the very best of luck with the two restaurants and with the truck and with everything that you've got going, and your vegan book, which will be exciting.
Good, thank you.
and if you guys want to keep up with what Mark is doing, he's on Instagram at Mark Hicks, and I'm at Posh Nosh Gal. If you enjoyed today's interview, please subscribe, rate and review. It'll help others find me.